Strike, Harper says. 5 days in an interrogation room with you, remember? He leans forward on his bunk, tilting his head mildly, like a curious bird. I am not fooled. His eyes burn with intensity. You had Futurius and Ner. You let him go. Because you love him? Is he not a mask, like any other? How dare you! I slam the plate down and stand. Harper grabs my arm, not releasing when I try to throw him off. Please, he says. I mean no harm. I swear it. I too have loved Shrike. Old pain flickers and fades in his eyes. I see no lie there. Only curiosity. I shove away his arm and, still assessing him, sit back down. I look out the open window of the barracks to the wide stretch of scrubby hills beyond. The moon barely lights the room, and the darkness is a comfort. Futurius is a mask like the rest of us, yes, I say. Bold, brave, strong, swift. But those were afterthoughts for him. The Bloodshrike's ring of office feels heavy on my finger, and I spin it around. I have never spoken of Elias to anyone. Whom would I speak to? My comrades at Blackcliff would have mocked me. My sisters would not have understood. I want to speak of him, I realize. I crave it. Elias sees people as they should be, I say. Not as they are. He laughs at himself. He gives of himself. In everything he does. Like with the first trial. I shiver at the memory. The augurs played with our minds, but Elias didn't falter. He looked death straight in the face and never considered leaving me behind. He didn't give up on me. He's the things I can't be. He's good. He never would have let the Commandant kill those prisoners. Especially not the children. The Commandant serves the Empire. I shake my head. What she did doesn't serve the Empire, I say. Not the Empire I fight for anyway. Harper watches me with an unsettling, fixed gaze. I wonder briefly if I've said too much, but then I realize that I don't care what he thinks. He is no friend of mine, and if he reports what I said to Marcus or the Commandant, it will change nothing. Bloodshrike! The shout makes both Harper and me jump, and a moment later the door bursts open to reveal an orc's courier, panting and coated in dirt from the road. The Emperor orders you to ride for Antium. Now! Bleeding skies. I'll never catch Elias if I detour to Antium. I'm in the middle of a mission, soldier, I say. And I'm not inclined to leave it half-finished. What's so damned important? War, Bloodshrike. The illustrious gens have declared war on each other.
Part 2. North. Chapter 25. Elias. For 2 weeks, the hours pass in a blur of nighttime riding, thieving, and skulking. Martial soldiers swarm over the countryside like locusts, tearing through every village and farmstead, every bridge and shack, in their search for me. But I am alone, and I am a mask. I ride hard, and Trera, desert-born and bred, eats up the miles. After a fortnight, we reach the eastern branch of the River Tyus, glimmering like the groove of a silver sim beneath the full moon. The night is quiet and bright, without a breath of wind, and I lead Trera up the riverbank until I find a place to cross. He slows as he splashes through the shallows, and when his hooves hit the northern bank, he tosses his head wildly, his eyes rolling back. Whoa, whoa, boy! I drop into the water and pull his bridle forward to get him up the bank. He whinnies and jerks his head. Did you get bitten? Let's see. I pull a blanket from one of the saddlebags and rub his legs gently, waiting for him to flinch when the blanket hits the bite. But he just lets me rub him down before turning south. This way. I try to urge him north, but he's having none of it. Strange. Up until now, He and I have gotten along fine. He's far more intelligent than any of Grandfather's horses, and he has more stamina, too.
Don't worry, boy. Nothing to fear.
Are you certain of that, Elias Vittorius?
10 bleeding hells! I don't believe it's the soul catcher until I see her sitting on a rock a few yards away. I'm not dead, I say quickly, like a child denying a wrongdoing.
Obviously.
The soul catcher stands and shakes back her dark hair, her black eyes fixed on me. Part of me wants to poke her to see how real she is.
You are, however, in my territory now.
The soul catcher nods east to a thick, dark line on the horizon, the forest of dusk. That's the waiting place? I never linked the oppressive trees of the soul catcher's lair to anything in my world.
Didn't you ever wonder where it was?
I mostly spent my time figuring out how to get out of it. I try again to pull Trera from the river. He doesn't budge. What do you want, soul catcher? She pats Trera between his ears, and he relaxes. She takes his reins from me and leads him north, as easily as if she's the one who's been with him for the past 2 weeks. I give the beast a dark look. Traitor.
Who says I want anything, Elias?
The soul catcher says.
I'm simply welcoming you to my lands.
Right. What a load of dung. You won't need to worry about me lingering. I have some place to be.
Ah.
I hear the smile in her voice.
That might be a problem. You see, when you stray so close to my realm, you disturb the spirits, Elias. For that, you must pay a price.
Welcoming me indeed. What price?
I'll show you. If you work quickly enough, I'll help you pass through these lands faster than you would have on horseback.
I mount Trera reluctantly and offer her a hand, though the idea of her otherworldly body so close to mine makes my blood turn to ice. But she ignores me and breaks into a run, her feet fleet as she matches Trera's canter with ease. A wind blows in from the west, and she catches it like a kite, her body floating upon it as if she is made of fluff. Too soon for it to be natural, the trees of the forest of dusk rise like a wall before us. 5 emissions never brought me this close to the forest. Centurions warned us to keep a good distance from its borders. Since anyone who didn't listen tended to disappear, it was one of the few rules no 5er was stupid enough to break.
Leave the horse, the soul catcher says. I'll make sure he's cared for.
The moment I step into the forest, the whispers begin. And now that my senses are not dulled by unconsciousness, I can make out the words more clearly. The red of the leaves is more vivid, the sweet scent of sap sharper.
Elias!
The soul catcher's voice dulls the soughing of the ghosts, and she nods to a space in the trees where a spirit paces. Tristus.
Why is he still here?
He won't listen to me,
the soul catcher says.
Perhaps he will listen to you.
I'm the reason he's dead.
Exactly. Hatred anchors him here. I don't mind ghosts who wish to stay, Elias. But not when they upset the other spirits. You need to talk to him. You need to help him move on.
And if I can't? The soul catcher shrugs.
You'll stay here until you can.
I need to get to Koth. The soul catcher turns her back on me.
Then you better get started.
Tristus refuses to speak with me. He first tries to attack me, but unlike when I was unconscious, his fists fly through my corporeal body. When he realizes he cannot hurt me, He rushes away, cursing. I try to follow, calling his name. By evening, my voice is hoarse. The soul-catcher appears beside me when the forest falls full dark. I wonder if she's been watching my ineptitude.
Come, she says tersely. If you do not eat, you will only weaken and fail again.
We walk along a stream to a cabin filled with pale wooden furniture and hand-woven rugs. Multifaceted tribal lamps of a dozen colors light the space. A bowl of stew steams on the table.
Cozy, I say. You live here?
The soul catcher turns to leave, but I step in front of her, and she collides with me. I expect cold to jolt through me, like when I touched the wraiths. But she's warm, almost feverish. The soul catcher jerks away, and I raise my eyebrows.
You're a living thing. I'm not human.
I gathered that, I say dryly. But you're not a wraith, either. And you have needs, obviously. I look at the house, the bed in the corner, the pot of stew bubbling over the fire. Food. Shelter. She glares and darts around me with unnatural swiftness. I'm reminded of the creature in Sarah's catacombs. Are you an ifrit? When she reaches for the door, I sigh in exasperation.
What harm is there in talking to me? I say. You must be lonely out here with only spirits to keep you company.
I expect her to turn on me or run away. But her hand freezes on the door handle. I move aside and gesture to the table.
Sit, please.
She eases back into the room, black eyes wary. I see a flash of curiosity deep within that opaque gaze. I wonder when she last spoke with someone who wasn't already dead.
I am not an ifrit,
she says after settling herself across from me.
They are weaker creatures, born of the lower elements, sand or shadow, clay, wind or water.
Then what are you? I say. Or, I take in her deceptively human form, save for those ageless eyes. What were you?
I was a girl, once.
The soul catcher looks down at the speckled pattern cast upon her hands by one of the tribal lamps. She sounds almost thoughtful.
A foolish girl who did one foolish thing. But that led to another foolish thing. Foolish became disastrous. Disastrous became murderous. And murderous became damned.
She sighs.
Now here I am, chained to this place, paying for my crimes by escorting ghosts from one realm to the next.
Quite a punishment.
It was quite a crime. But you know about crime and repentance.
She stands, severe once more.
Sleep where you wish. I will not disturb you. But remember, if you want your own chance at repentance, you must find a way to help Tristus.
Days blur together. Time feels different here. I sense Tristus but don't see him. As the days pass, I plunge deeper into the woods in my increasingly agitated attempts to find him. Finally, I discover a part of the forest that looks as if it hasn't seen sunlight in years. A river rushes nearby, and I spot an angry red glow ahead. Fire? The glow intensifies, and I consider calling out to the soul catcher. But I smell no smoke, and when I get close, I realize it's not a fire I saw, but a grove of trees, enormous, interconnected, and wrong. Their gnarled trunks glow as if consumed from within by the flames of the hells.
Shivers! Shaver!
Voices within the trees cry out, the sound grating and harsh.
Don't leave us alone!
A figure kneels at the base of the largest tree, hand stretched flat against the burning trunk. The soul catcher. The fire from the trees trickles into her hands and spreads to her neck, her stomach. In the space of a breath, her body is ablaze, smokeless flames of red and black consuming her. I cry out, rushing toward her, but as suddenly as she is consumed, the flames die and she is whole again. The trees still glow, but their fire is muted, tamed. The soul catcher crumples, and I pick her up. She's as light as a child.
You should not have seen that,
she whispers as I carry her from the grove.
I did not know you would travel so deep into the forest.
Was that the gateway to the hells? Is that where the evil spirits go? The soul catcher shakes her head.
Good or evil, Elias, spirits simply move on. But it is a hell of sorts, at least for those trapped within it.
She collapses on a chair inside her cabin, her face grey. I tuck a blanket around her shoulders, relieved when she doesn't protest. You told me ifrits are made of the lesser elements. I sit across from her. Are there higher elements?
Just one,
the soul catcher whispers. Her hostility is so diminished that she seems like a different creature.
Fire.
You're a djinn. It dawns on me suddenly, though I can hardly make sense of it.
Aren't you?
I thought some scholar king tricked the other fey creatures into betraying and destroying your kind long ago.
The djinn weren't destroyed,
the soul catcher says.
Only trapped. And it wasn't the fey who betrayed us. It was a young, prideful djinn girl.
You? She pushes the blanket away.
I was wrong to bring you here, she says. Wrong to take advantage of your seizures to speak with you. Forgive me.
Take me to Koth, then. I seize upon her apology. I need to get out of here.
Please, I should be there by now.
The soul catcher regards me coldly.
Damn it, she's going to keep me here. Skies know for how long.
But then, to my relief, she nods once.
In the morning, then.
She hobbles to the door, waving me off when I try to help.
Wait,
I say.
Soul catcher, Shaver.
Her body stiffens at the sound of her name.
Why did you bring me here?
Don't tell me it was just for Tristus, because that doesn't make any sense. It's your job to comfort souls, not mine.
I needed you to help your friend.
I can hear the lie in her voice.
That is all.
With that, she disappears out the door, and I curse. No closer to understanding her than the first time I met her. But Koth and Darin await. All I can do is take my freedom and go. As promised, Shaver delivers me to Koth in the morning, despite the impossibility of such a thing. We depart from her cabin at a stroll, and minutes later, the trees above are bare. A quarter hour after that, we are deep in the shadows of the Nevernese range, crunching through a fresh layer of snow.
This is my realm, Elias,
Shaver says to my unspoken question. She is far less wary now, as if my use of her name has unlocked a long-buried civility.
I can travel where and how I wish, when I am within its boundaries.
She nods to a break in the trees ahead.
Koth is through there. If you wish to succeed, Elias, You must be swift. Rathana is a mere 2 weeks away.
We walk to a high ridge that overlooks the long black ribbon of the river Dusk, but I hardly notice. The moment I am free of the trees, I want nothing more than to turn back and lose myself among them. The smell hits me first. It's what I imagine the hells must smell like. Then the despair, borne upon the wind in the hair-raising cries of men and women who know nothing but torment and suffering. The cries are so unlike the peaceful whispers of the dead that I wonder how they can exist in the same world. I lift my eyes to the monstrosity of cold iron and carved Stygian rock that erupts from the mountain at the north end of the valley. Koth Prison.
"Do not go, Elias," Shaeva whispers. "Should you find yourself trapped behind those walls, your fate will be dark indeed."
My fate is dark anyway.
I reach back and loosen my sims in their sheaths, taking comfort from their weight. At least this way, it won't be for nothing.
Chapter 26. Helene. In the 3 weeks it takes Harper and me to reach Antium, deep fall arrives in the capital, a red-gold blanket edged with white frost. The smell of pumpkin and cinnamon fills the air, and thick wood smoke curls up into the sky. But beneath the glowing foliage and behind heavy oaken doors, an Illustrian rebellion brews.
"Bloodshrike."
Harper emerges from the martial garrison perched just outside the city.
"The Black Guard escort is on its way from the barracks," he says. "The garrison sergeant says the streets are dangerous, particularly for you."
All the more reason to get in quickly. I squeeze my hand over dozens of messages in my pocket, all from Father, each more urgent than the next. "We can't afford to wait."
"We also can't afford to lose the Empire's highest internal enforcer on the eve of a possible civil war,"
Harper says with typical frankness.
"Empire first, Bloodshrike."
"You mean Commandant first?" A hairline crack fractures Arvatus's unruffled facade, but he leashes whatever emotion lurks within.
"Empire first, Bloodshrike. Always. We wait."
I don't argue. Weeks on the road with him, riding for Antium as if wraiths were on our backs, have given me a new respect for Harper's skills as a mask. At Blackcliff, he and I never crossed paths. He was 4 years ahead of me, a fiver when I was a yearling, a cadet when I was a fiver, a skull when I was a cadet. In all that time, he must never have distinguished himself, for I never heard anything about him. But I see now why the Commandant made him an ally. Like her, he has iron-fisted control over his emotions. A rumble of hooves beyond the garrison has me leaping upon my saddle in an instant. Moments after I do, a company of soldiers appears, the screaming shrikes on their breastplates marking them as my men. Upon seeing me, most salute smartly. Others appear more reluctant. I straighten my back and glower. These are my men, and their obedience should be immediate.
"Lieutenant Harper,"
one man, a captain and the commanding officer of this company, kicks his horse forward.
"Bloodshrike."
The fact that he addressed Harper before me is offensive enough. The disgusted look on his face as he gives me the once-over has my fist aching to connect with his jaw.
"Your name, soldier?"
I say.
"Captain Gallus Sergius."
"Captain Gallus Sergius, sir," I want to say. I know him. He has a son at Blackcliff 2 years younger than me. The boy was a good fighter. Big mouth, though.
"Captain," I say, "why are you looking at me like I just seduced your wife?"
The captain draws back his chin and stares down his nose.
"How dare!"
I backhand him. Blood flies from his mouth, and his eyes spark, but he holds his tongue.
The men of his company shift, a mutinous whisper rippling through them. The next time you speak out of turn, I say, I'll have you whipped. Fall in. We're late. As the rest of the Black Guard falls into formation, creating a shield against attack, Harper pulls his horse up beside mine. I examine the faces around me surreptitiously. They are masks, and Black Guards to boot. The best of the best. Their expressions are flat and unfeeling. But I can sense the anger simmering beneath the surface. I have not won their respect. I keep one hand on the sim at my waist as we approach the Emperor's palace, a monstrosity built of white limestone that abuts the northern border of the city, the foothills of the Nevenese range at its back. Arrow slats and guard towers line the crenellated battlements. The red and gold flags of Jen's Tyre have been replaced with Marcus's banner, a sledgehammer on a black field. Many marshals traversing the streets have stopped to watch us pass. They peer out from thick furry hats and knitted mufflers, fear and curiosity mingling on their faces as they eye me, the new Bloodshrike.
Little singer.
I start, and my horse tosses his head in irritation. Arvatas, riding beside me, cuts me a look, but I ignore him and search the crowd. A flash of white catches my eyes. Amid a gaggle of urchins and vagrants gathered around a bin fire, I spot the curve of a hideously scarred jaw with a wing of snowy hair swinging down to hide it. Dark eyes meet mine. Then she's gone, lost in the streets. Why in the bleeding skies is Cook in Antium? I've never seen the scholars as enemies, exactly. An enemy is someone you fear, someone who might destroy you. But the scholars will never destroy the marshals. They can't read. They can't fight. They have no steel craft. They are a slave class. A lesser class. But Cook is different. She is something more. I am forced to push the old bat from my mind when we arrive at the palace gate, and I see who awaits us. The Commandant. Somehow she beat me here. By her calm demeanor and neat appearance, I'd guess it was by at least a day. All the men of the Black Guard salute upon seeing her, instantly giving her more respect than they afforded me. Bloodshrike, the words saunter off her tongue. The road has taken its toll on you. I'd offer you a chance to rest, but the Emperor insisted I bring you in immediately. I don't need to rest, Karis, I say. I thought you'd still be chasing scholars all over the countryside. The Emperor requested my counsel, the Commandant says. I could not, of course, refuse. But be assured that I am not idle whilst here. The prisons of Antium are being cleansed of the scholar disease as we speak, and my men carry out the purges farther south. Come, Shrike. The Emperor awaits. She glances at my men. Your escort is unnecessary. Her insult is obvious. Why do you need an escort, Bloodshrike? Are you scared? I open my mouth to retort, but then hold my tongue. She probably wants me to engage so that she can embarrass me further. I expect Karis to lead me to the courtier-packed throne room. In fact, I'd hoped to see my father there. But instead, Emperor Marcus waits for us in a long drawing room filled with plush seats and low-hanging lamps. I see why he's chosen the space the second I enter. No windows. About bleeding time. His mouth twists in disgust when I enter. 10 hells, couldn't you have taken a bath before showing up? Not if it makes you want to get an inch closer to me. Civil war matters more than my hygiene, Your Imperial Majesty. How may I be of service? You mean beyond catching the Empire's top fugitive? Marcus's sarcasm is undercut by the hatred in his piss-yellow eyes. I was close to catching him, I say, but you called me back. I suggest you tell me what you need so that I can return to the hunt. I see his blow coming but still lose my breath when it lands on my jaw. A hot rush of blood fills my mouth. I make myself swallow it. Don't cross me. Marcus's spit lands on my face. You are my Bloodshrike, the sword that executes my will. He takes a sheet of parchment and slams it down on a table beside us. 10 gens, he says, all Illustrian. 4 have banded together with Gens Rufia. They propose an Illustrian candidate to replace me as emperor. The other 5 offer their own paters for the throne. All have sent assassins after me. I want a public execution and their heads on pikes in front of the palace by tomorrow morning. Understood? Do you have proof? He doesn't need proof. The commandant, lurking silently near the door beside Harper, cuts me off. These gens have attacked the imperial house, as well as Gens Veturia. They openly call for the emperor to be ousted. They are traitors. Are you an oathbreaker too? Marcus says to me. Shall I toss you off Cardium Rock and shame your name for 5 generations, Shrike? I hear the rock thirsts for the blood of traitors, for the more it drinks, the stronger the empire grows. Cardium Rock is a cliff near the palace with a pit of bones at its base. It's used to execute only 1 kind of criminal, traitors to the throne. I make myself examine the list of names. Some of these gens are as powerful as Gens Aquila, a few even more so. Your Majesty, perhaps we can try to negotiate. Marcus closes the space between us, and though my mouth still bleeds from his last attack, I hold my ground. I will not let him cow me. I force myself to look up into his eyes, only to suppress a shudder at what I see within. A controlled sort of madness, a rage that needs only the smallest spark to ignite into a conflagration. Your father tried to negotiate. Marcus crowds me until my back is against a wall. The commandant watches, bored. Harper looks away. His unending blathering only gave the traitorous gens time to find more allies, to attempt more assassinations. Do not speak to me of negotiation. I didn't survive the hell of Blackcliff to negotiate. I didn't go through those bleeding trials so I could negotiate. I didn't kill... He stops. A powerful and unexpected grief suffuses his body, as if another person deep within is attempting to get out. A tendril of fear unfurls in my belly. This is, perhaps, more terrifying than anything I've seen from Marcus yet, because it makes him a human. I will hold the throne, Bloodshrike, he says quietly. I've given up too much not to. Keep your vow to me, and I will bring order to this empire. Betray me, and watch it burn. The empire must come first. Above your desires, your friendships, your wants. My father spoke so adamantly when I last saw him. I know what he'd say now. We are Aquila, daughter. Loyal to the end. I must do Marcus's bidding. I must stop this civil war, or the empire will crumble under the weight of Illustrian greed. I bow my head to Marcus. Consider it done, Your Majesty.
Chapter 27. Liar. Liar. The soul catcher tells me I do not have enough time to get Darin out of Koth if I remain with Afia's caravan. I'll move twice as fast if I go ahead on my own, and by the time you reach Koth, I'll have found a way to break Darin out. We, or he at least, will await you in the cave I told Afia about. In case it doesn't go as planned, use the map of Koth that I drew and make a plan of your own in the time you have. If I fail, you must succeed. For your brother, and for your people. Whatever happens, remember what you told me. There is hope in life. I hope I see you again. Evie.
7 sentences. 7 bleeding sentences after weeks of traveling together, of saving each other, of fighting and surviving. 7 sentences, and then he disappears like smoke in a north wind. Even now, 4 weeks after he's gone, my anger flares and fury reddens my gaze. Forget that Elias did not say goodbye. He did not even give me a chance to object to his decision. Instead, he left a note. A pathetically short note. I find that my jaw is tight, my hands in a white-knuckled grip on the bow I hold. Keenan sighs beside me, his arms crossed as he leans against a tree in the clearing we've taken over. He knows me by now. He knows what I'm thinking about that's making me so angry. Focus, Laya. I try to push Elias from my mind and do as Keenan asks. I sight my target, an old bucket hanging from a scarlet-leafed maple, and let my arrow fly. It misses. Beyond the clearing, the tribal wagons creak as the wind howls around them, an eerie sound that frosts my blood. Deep autumn, already, and winter soon. Winter means snow. Snow means blocked mountain passes, and blocked passes mean not reaching Koth, Darin, or Elias until spring. Stop worrying. Keenan pulls my right arm taut as I draw the bowstring again. Warmth emanates from him, beating back the icy air. His touch on my bow arm sends a tingle all the way up my neck, and I'm certain he must notice it. He clears his throat, his strong hand holding mine steady. Keep your shoulders back. We shouldn't have stopped so early. My muscles burn, but at least I haven't dropped the bow after 10 minutes, like I did the first few times. We stand just outside the circle of wagons, making best use of the last scraps of daylight before the sun sinks into the forests to our west. It's not even dark yet, I add. We could have crossed the river. I look west, beyond the forest, to a square tower, a martial garrison. I'd like to put the river between us and them, anyway. I put down the bow. I'm going to talk to Afia. I wouldn't. Izzy sticks her tongue out of the corner of her mouth as she draws back her own bowstring a few yards away from me. She's in a mood. Izzy's target is an old boot atop a low-hanging branch. She's graduated to using actual arrows. I'm still using blunted sticks so as not to accidentally murder anyone unfortunate enough to get in my way. She doesn't like being so deep in the Empire, or being within sight of the forest. Gibran, lounging on a tree stump near Izzy, nods at the northeastern horizon, where low green hills stretch, thick with old-growth trees. The Forest of Dusk is the sentinel on Marin's western border, one so effective that in 500 years of martial expansion, even the Empire hasn't been able to penetrate it. You'll see, Gibran goes on. When we cross the East Branch north of here, she'll be even grumpier than normal. Very superstitious, my sister. Are you afraid of the forest, Gibran? Izzy surveys the distant trees curiously. Have you ever gotten close? Once, Gibran says, and his ever-present humour fades. All I remember is wanting to leave. Gibran! Izzy! Afia calls from across the camp. Firewood! Gibran groans and flops his head back. As he and Izzy are the youngest in the caravan, Afia assigns them, and usually me, the most menial tasks, gathering firewood, doing the dishes, scrubbing the laundry. She might as well put bleeding slave's cuffs on us, Gibran grumbles. Then a sly look crosses his face. Hit that shot! Gibran flashes his lightning smile at Izzy, and a blush rises in her cheeks. And I'll gather firewood for a week. Miss? And it's on you. Izzy draws the bow, sights, and knocks the boot off the branch easily. Gibran curses. Don't be such a baby, Izzy says. I'll still keep you company while you do all the work. Izzy slings her bow on her back and gives Gibran a hand up. For all his blustering, he holds on to her a little longer than he needs to, his eyes lingering on her as she walks ahead of him. I hide a smile, thinking of what Izzy said to me a few nights ago as we fell into sleep. It's nice to be admired, Lyra, by someone who means well. It's nice to be thought beautiful. They pass Afia, who chivvies them along. I clench my jaw and look away from the tribeswoman. A feeling of impotence seizes me. I want to tell her we should keep going, but I know she won't listen. I want to tell her she was wrong for letting Elias leave, for not even bothering to wake me until he was well away. But she won't care. And I want to rage at her for refusing to allow me or Keenan to take a horse and track Elias down. But she'll just roll her eyes and tell me again what she told me when I learned Elias left.
My duty is to get you safely to Koth, and you herring off after him interferes.
I must admit that she has carried out her duty with remarkable cleverness. Here, in the heart of the Empire, the countryside is crawling with martial soldiers. Afia's caravan has been searched a dozen times. Only her savvy as a smuggler has kept us alive. I put the bow down, my focus shattered.
Help me get dinner going?
Keenan gives me a rueful smile. He knows well the look on my face. He's patiently suffered my frustration since Elias left, and he's realized the only cure is distraction.
It's my turn to cook, he says.
I fall into step beside him, preoccupied enough that I do not notice Izzy running toward us until she calls out.
Come quickly, she says. Scholars, her family, on the run from the Empire.
Keenan and I follow Izzy back to camp to find Afia speaking rapidly in Sardis with Riz and Varna. A small group of anxious scholars looks on, their clothing torn, faces streaked with dirt and tears. Two dark-eyed women who appear to be sisters stand together. One of them has her arm around a girl of perhaps six. The man with them carries a little boy no more than two. Afia turns away from Riz and Varna, both of whom have similar, glowering expressions. Zaire keeps his distance, but he doesn't look happy either.
"We can't help you," Afia says to the scholars. "I will not bring down the Marshal's wrath upon my tribe."
"They're killing everyone," one of the women says. "No survivors, miss. They're even killing scholar prisoners, massacring them in their cells."
It is as if the earth at my feet has dropped away.
"What?"
I push past Keenan and Afia.
"What did you say about scholar prisoners?" "The marshals are butchering them," the woman turns to me. "Every single prisoner, from Sarah to Silas, to our city, Estium, 50 miles west of here. Antium is next, we hear, and after that, Koth. That woman, the mask, the one they call the Commandant. She's killing them all."
Chapter 28 Helene.
"What are you going to do about Captain Sergius?" Harper asks, as we make for Antium's Black Guard barracks. "Some of the gens on Marcus's list are allied with Gen Sergia. He has heavy support within the Black Guard."
"It's nothing a few whippings won't fix."
"You can't whip them all. What will you do if there is open dissent?"
"They can bend to my will, Harper, or I can break them. It's not complicated."
"Don't be stupid, Shrike."
The anger in his voice surprises me, and when I glance at him, his green eyes flash.
"There are 200 of them, and 2 of us. If they turn on us, en masse, we're dead. Why else wouldn't Marcus just order them to take out his enemies himself? He knows he might not be able to control the Black Guard. He can't risk them directly defying him. But he can risk them defying you. The Commandant must have put him up to it. If you fail, then you're dead, which is exactly what she wants.
And what you want, too."
"Why would I tell you any of this if I wanted you dead?"
"Bleeding skies, I don't know, Harper. Why do you do anything? You don't make sense. You never have." I frown in irritation. "I don't have time for this. I need to figure out how I'm going to get to the paters of 10 of the best guarded gens in the Empire." Harper is about to retort, but we've reached the barracks, a great square building built around a training field. Most of the men within play dice or cards, cups of ale beside them. I clench my teeth in disgust. The old Bloodshrike is gone for a few weeks and discipline has already gone to the hells. As I pass through the field, some of the men eye me curiously. Others give me blatant once-overs that make me want to rip their eyes out. Most just seem angry. "We take out Sergius," I say quietly, "and his closest allies." "Force won't work,"
Harper murmurs. You need to outwit them. You need secrets.
Secrets are a snake's way of doing business.
And snakes survive, Harper says. The old Bloodshrike traded in secrets. It's why he was so valuable to Jen's Tyre.
I don't know any secrets, Harper. But even as I say it, I realize it's not true. Sergius, for instance, his son talked about many things that he probably shouldn't have. Rumors at Blackcliff spread quickly. If anything that Sergius the Younger said was true...
I can deal with his allies, Harper says. I'll get help from the other plebeians in the guard, but we need to move swiftly.
Get it done, I say. I'll speak with Sergius.
I find the captain with his feet up in the barracks mess hall, his cronies gathered around him. Sergius? I don't comment on the fact that he doesn't stand. I must solicit your opinion on something. Privately. I turn my back and make for the Bloodshrike's quarters, seething when he doesn't follow immediately.
Captain, I begin, when he finally walks into my quarters, but he interrupts.
Miss Aquila, he says, and I practically choke on my own saliva. I haven't been addressed as Miss Aquila since I was about 6. Before you ask for advice or favours, he goes on, let me explain something. You'll never control the Blackguard. At best, you'll be a pretty figurehead. So whatever orders that plebeian dog of an emperor gave you...
How's your wife?
I hadn't planned to be so direct. But if he's going to be a dog, then I'll have to crawl down to his level until I get him on a leash.
My wife knows her place, Sergius says warily.
Unlike you, I say, sleeping with her sister and her cousin. How many bastards do you have running around now? 6? 7?
If you're trying to blackmail me...
The sneer on Sergius's face is practiced.
It won't work. My wife knows of my women and my bastards. She smiles and does her duty. You should do the same. Put on a dress, marry for the good of your gens, and produce heirs. In fact, I have a son.
Yes, you cretin, I know your son. Cadet Sergius hates his father. I wish someone would just tell her, the boy once said of his mother. She could tell grandfather. He'd kick my ass of a father out into the cold.
Maybe your wife does know, I smile at Sergius. Or maybe you've kept your dalliances a secret, and learning of them would devastate her. Maybe she would tell her father, who, in rage at the insult, would offer her shelter and withdraw the money that funds your crumbling illustrian estate.
You can't very well be pater of Jen Sergio with no money. Can you, Lieutenant Sergius?
That's Captain Sergius!
You've just been demoted. Sergius first turns white, then an unusual shade of purple. When the shock drains from his face, it's replaced by a helpless rage that I find quite satisfying. He straightens his back, salutes, and, in a tone suitable to addressing a superior officer, speaks.
Bloodshrike, he says. How may I serve you?
Once Sergius is barking my orders to his toadies, the rest of the Blackguard fall into line, albeit reluctantly. An hour after walking into the commander's quarters, I am in the Blackguard war room, planning the attack. 5 teams with 30 men each. I point to 5 gens on the list. I want paters, maters, and children older than 13 in chains and waiting at Cardium Rock by dawn. Younger children are to remain under armed guard. Get in and out quietly. And keep it clean.
What about the other 5 gens? Lieutenant Sergius says. Gens Rufia and its allies.
I know Pater Rufius. He's a typical illustrian with typical prejudices. And he was once a friend to my father. According to father's missives, Pater Rufius has attempted to pull Gens Aquila into his traitorous coalition 12 times already. Leave them to me. The dress I wear is white, gold, and supremely uncomfortable,
probably because I haven't worn one since I was a four-year-old forced to participate in a wedding. I should have put one on sooner. The expression on Hannah's face alone, like she swallowed a live snake, would have been worth it.
"You look beautiful,"
Livy whispers as we file into the dining room.
"Those idiots will never see it coming." "But only,"
she gives me a warning look, her blue eyes wide,
"if you rein yourself in. Pater Rufius is smart, even if he is foul. He'll be suspicious. Pinch me if you see me doing anything stupid."
I finally notice the room and my jaw drops. My mother has outdone herself, laying the table with snow-white china and long, clear vases of winter roses. Creamy tapers bathe the room in a welcoming glow, and a white whistling thrush sings sweetly from a cage in the corner. Hannah follows Livy and me into the room. Her dress is similar to mine, and her hair is done up in a mass of icy curls. She wears a small gold circlet atop, a not-so-subtle nod to her approaching nuptials.
"This won't work," she says. "I don't understand why you don't just take your guards, sneak into the traitors' houses, and kill them all. Isn't that what you're good at?"
"I didn't want to get blood on my dress," I say dryly. To my surprise, Hannah cracks a smile, and then quickly raises a hand to her face to hide it. My heart lifts, and I find that I am grinning back at her, just like when we shared a joke as girls. But a second later she scowls.
"Skies only know what everyone will say when they learn we invited them here only to trap them."
She steps away from me and my temper snaps. "Does she think I want to do this?"
"You can't marry Marcus and expect to avoid getting blood on your hands, sister,"
I hiss at her. "Might as well get into the habit of it."
"Stop it, both of you."
Livy looks between us as, outside the drawing room, the front door opens and Father greets our guests.
"Remember who the actual enemy is."
Seconds later, Father enters, trailing a group of Illustrian men, each flanked by a dozen bodyguards. They secure every inch, from the windows to the table to the drapes, before allowing their paters to file in. The head of Jens Rufia leads, his yellow and purple silk robes straining against his paunch, a portly man, gone to seed after leaving the military, but still sly as a hyena. When he spots me, his hand goes to the sword at his waist, a sword I doubt he remembers how to use, judging from those flaccid arms.
"Pater Aquilus," he brays, "what is the meaning of this?"
My father glances at me with an expression of surprise. He is so sincere that for a second, even I'm fooled.
"This is my eldest," Father says, "Helene Aquila."
He uses my name purposefully.
"Though I suppose we must call her Bloodshrike now. Right, darling?"
He pats my cheek patronizingly.
"I thought it would be good for her to learn a bit from our discussions."
"She is the Emperor's Bloodshrike."
Pater Rufius doesn't remove his hands from his sword.
"Is this an ambush, Aquilus? Is that what we've come to?"
"She is the Emperor's Bloodshrike," Father says. "And as such, she is useful to us, even if she doesn't have a whit of sense about how to use her position. We'll teach her, of course. Come, Rufius. You've known me for years. Have your men search the premises if you must. If you see anything alarming, you and the others can depart."
I smile openly at Pater Rufius, making my voice warm and winsome, the way I've seen Livy do when she's charming someone into giving her information.
"Do stay, Pater," I say. "I wish to honour the new title bestowed upon me, and it is only through watching experienced men such as yourself work that I will be able to do so."
"Blackcliff isn't for mice, girl."
He doesn't take his brick of a hand off his sword.
"What game are you playing?"
I look at Father as if bewildered.
"No game, sir," I say. "I am a daughter of Jens Aquila, above all else. As for Blackcliff, there are ways to survive there, if one is a woman."
Even as surprise registers in his eyes,
A look of mingled disgust and interest passes across his face. The look makes my skin crawl, but I steel myself. Go on, you half-wit. Underestimate me. He grunts and sits. The other four paters, Rufius's allies, follow suit, and Mother sweeps in shortly after, followed by a taster and a row of slaves bearing trays groaning with food. Mother seats me across from Rufius, as I requested. Throughout the meal I let my laugh go high. I toy with my hair. I act bored during key parts of the conversation. I giggle with Livy. When I glance at Hannah, she's chattering with another of the paters, distracting him utterly. When the meal is over, Father stands.
"Let us retire to my study, gentlemen," he says. "Hell, my dear, bring the wine."
Father doesn't wait for my response as he leads the men out, their bodyguards following.
"Go to your rooms, both of you," I whisper to Livy and Hannah. "No matter what you hear, stay there until Father comes for you."
When I approach the study a few minutes later with a tray of wine and tumblers, the pater's many bodyguards are arrayed outside. The space is too small for them to fit within. I smile at the two men flanking the door, and they grin back. Idiots. After I enter the room, Father closes the door behind me and puts a hand on my shoulder.
"Helene is a good girl, and loyal to her gens."
He brings me into the conversation seamlessly.
"She'll do as we ask, and that will get us closer to the Emperor."
As they discuss a potential alliance, I carry the tray around the table and past the window, where I pause for an indiscernible moment, a signal to the blackguard waiting on the grounds. Slowly I serve the wine. My father takes a leisurely sip of each glass before I hand them off to the paters. I pass the last glass to Pater Rufius. His piggish eyes fix on mine, his finger brushing against my palm deliberately. It is easy enough to hide my disgust, especially when I hear the faintest thud outside the study. "Don't kill them, Helene," I remind myself. "You need them alive for a public execution." With a small secret smile just for Pater Rufius, I slowly pull my hand away from his. Then, from the slits cut into my dress, I draw out my Sims. By dawn, the Black Guard have rounded up Illustrian traitors and their families. City criers have announced the impending executions at Cardium Rock. Thousands of people surround the square that stretches around the bone pit at the base of the rock. The Illustrians and Mercators in the crowd have been ordered to voice their disapproval of the traitors, lest they face a similar fate. The plebeians need no encouragement. The top of the rock slopes down in three terraces. Illustrian courtiers, including my family, stand upon the closest terrace. Leaders from less powerful gens stand on the top tier. Near the edge of the cliff, Marcus surveys the crowd. He wears full battle regalia, an iron circlet upon his head. The commandant stands beside him, murmuring something into his ear. He nods, and, as the sun rises, addresses those gathered, his words carried through the crowd by the criers.
10 Illustrian gens chose to defy your augur, chosen emperor," he roars. 10 Illustrian paters believed that they knew better than the holy seers who have guided us for centuries. These paters bring shame to their gens through their treasonous actions. They are traitors to the Empire. There is only one punishment for traitors.
He nods, and Harper and I, standing on either side of a writhing, gagged Pater Rufius, drag the man to his feet. Without ceremony, Marcus takes Rufius by his garish robes and casts him over the side of the cliff. The sound of his body hitting the pit below is lost in the cheers of the crowd. The next 9 paters follow swiftly, and when they are nothing but a mass of broken bones and shattered skulls at the base of the cliff, Marcus turns to their heirs
kneeling chained, and lined up for all of Antium to see. The flags of their gens fly behind them.
"You will swear your fealty," he says, "upon